Deuteronomy chapter 33. Under consideration, as Landon just read here a few minutes ago. Remember last chapter, it was the Song of Moses. We just finished up before that, the cursings and blessings, and Moses delivered this song that helped Israel remember those cursings and blessings as they get ready to go into the Promised Land. And at the end of that chapter, remember the Lord told Moses that same thing was going to happen to him that happened to Aaron. Moses needs to now go up to Mount Nebo, and there he's going to die. And next chapter, we'll read about that. Probably one of the sadder chapters of the Old Testament anyway. This week, we're learning about Moses' last words to Israel, his blessing to Israel. The first question has to do with verses 1 through 5, which we see up here on the screen. What was the meaning behind this kind of blessing, and how does Moses introduce these words? He will speak to each tribe. And I believe Dennis had the last question, so Matt, would you like to answer question number 1 about the kind of blessing and how he introduces the words he speaks to tribes?
The meaning of the blessing, I'll just address the questions real quick. The meaning of the blessing, it seems, is important to the context of the entire chapter. Remember, the entire book of Deuteronomy has taken place over a fairly short period of time. They're on one side of the Jordan getting ready to come over, and Moses has been reminding them of who they are and what God has done for them and what they're supposed to do when they go into the Promised Land. And this is the very last blessing of Moses to the children of Israel, and it's kind of a reiteration of Jacob's blessings to his sons. There are some differences, but it's similar in what Jacob had said to them, and it seems to be kind of a reminder of that, and just overall what the tribes are supposed to do once they go into the Promised Land. And he introduces them, these blessings, these thoughts, kind of with a recap, which he does very often, at least in the book of Deuteronomy. He gives a recap of some of the things that have happened, and maybe shows just a few different, sheds some light on some different aspects of what has happened since Israel has been freed from Egypt. And there are some things in this section, the beginning of his blessings, that are difficult to understand, and some that have very different viewpoints from different commentators and different scholars. But for the most part, it seems that where it says the Lord came from Sinai, dawned on them from Seir, shone on Mount Paran, and came with 10,000s of saints. That he came with is probably better translated as from 10,000s of saints. He left those holy ones, as what that Hebrew word means. He left the holiness, the sanctitude of heaven, and came down into that area, to Sinai, Seir, which is where the Edomites live, and Mount Paran, which is the southern region of Canaan, which is kind of encloses the area of the wanderings. That whole area is where Israel spent their time in the wilderness right before they got to where they are right now, which is what I think is being said there. There's some commentators that say that the glory of what was done on Sinai can be seen from those regions, and whether or not that's true, I don't know. But it seems to be that's just where these events of the last several books have taken place. And there's another contentious thing here in verse 2, where it says, "Came from his right hand came a fiery law for them." Some modern translations, like the New American Standard and the ESV, do not use the word law there. And that word law in Hebrew is dath, I believe. And it's the only time that it occurs in the Old Testament before the it's claimed to be a Chaldean word, and it's used in Ezra and Esther and Daniel, but never, this is the only time it's used pre-captivity, pre-Babylonian captivity, and the modern English translations don't use it. So I'm wondering if maybe it's a transcript that was mistranscribed or older from beyond when the King James translators used it, or you know perhaps there's just some issue with the transcript that they use there, because I can't imagine that a Chaldee word would have found itself in the original transcripts. Maybe someone else has some information on that. And the rest of it, he is kind of, verses 3 through 5 is kind of saying, the Lord has his people, he loves Israel, and he has chosen you as their people. I like how the ESV says verse 3, 4, and 5. Yes, he loved his people. All his holy ones were in his hand. So they followed in your steps, receiving direction from you. When Moses commanded us a law as a possession for the assembly of Jacob, thus the Lord became king in Jeshurun when the heads of the people were gathered together. So when in the Exodus and his love for his people, he brought them out, Moses gave them a law, and when he did that, cemented these people as the Lord's, and the Lord reigned over them.
Right. Yeah, it seems like the giving of law is what made the Lord, sealed the covenant and made the Lord the King of Israel. Curious what word was used rather than law.
Oh, sorry. There was, I actually had something else. So when Moses commanded us a law, that is the Hebrew word Torah. And all that in the modern translations do use that word, but in the Old King James and in the New King James, and I'm sure other translations where it says fiery law, that's not Torah. That's the word daf. And the modern translations omit that. But later on in verse four where it says law, that is Torah.
So they don't replace it with another word. Who else would like to address this first question of the meaning behind the blessing and how Moses introduces the words he speaks to each tribe? Sean?
This chapter is pleasantly positive and uplifting, and a stark contrast from the tone that we've seen for most of the end of the book of Deuteronomy. We notice that the blessing section, for example, is quite pitiful and short compared to the lengthy section outlining the curses. And even just in the last chapter, chapter 32, Moses gave a prophetic guarantee of the apostasy of the people to come at a future date. So this chapter, a much more positive and uplifting tone, reassuring the people that God was with them and that he would indeed bless them. This chapter, of course, is poetic. It's full of metaphors and figures of speech. And it's also a wonderful example of two of probably the most common poetic techniques that were used by the ancient Hebrews. One is wordplay, and this is especially apparent when we see some of the words that are used in relation to some of the tribal names. We'll get into that as we go on, but certain Hebrew words that sound similar to certain of the tribal names are given as sort of a wordplay. This is a very ancient technique among the Hebrews, found all the way in the early chapters of the book of Genesis. The name Adam, Adam, is a play on the Hebrew word for ground, which is Adamah. So Adam was literally the dirt man, because God made him out of the dirt. That's very common in Hebrew writing. Another common poetic technique that dominates this whole chapter is parallelism. And specifically, we're shown here a lot of synonymous parallelism. So I'll give you an example of this right off the bat in verse 6. Let Reuben live and do not die, nor let his men be few. Those are two ways of saying the same thing. And so parallelism is used throughout Hebrew poetry. It dominates this entire chapter, where something is stated in two different ways of essentially describing the same thing. And I thought I might also just throw in that Moses is called in these verses a man of God. That's usually a title that's only given to prophets. And that helps us to know that this means that Moses is not just speaking, there it is, right there in verse 1. Moses is not just speaking of his own wishes and think-sos. This is a blessing that's not just coming from Moses acting like a father to the people, but from God himself. And so we can be assured that these things were from the Lord because of that introduction there in verse 1.
Yeah, I found the man of God description kind of interesting. And, you know, in the books of Kings and Samuel, it's, like you said, the description of prophets. And Caleb describes Moses as a man of God here in the next book in Joshua. That is kind of interesting. So what you're saying, that Moses, one of his poetic things was Hebrew puns, like I think you're making a mistake. Or who else would like to address this? Bart?
Yeah, I like, also I noted that Jacob gave blessings, and they were kind of grumpy blessings when Jacob gave his. And Moses here seems to dwell on the positive, and obviously that's from the Lord. Here they are at the beginning of this great journey, and so they get positive blessings, even if they're rebellious, as many of them were. The way I look at this passage right here, and as Matt pointed out, one of the popular ways is to say that the Lord came from angels, came down from heaven. But I think this is describing the event of the Exodus and the wilderness wandering. And I think the tens of thousands of saints are the Israelites. And again, it is debated. This is very, you know, all the commentators said, oh, this is hard, then, you know, there's great controversy. But I think the context upholds that idea, because here the Lord descends on Sinai, and then the Lord and the people move out from Sinai in this great majestic journey through the wilderness. And Seir and Mount Paran, the wilderness of Paran, are part of that. And then the rest of the context of this introduction is the people. So the people go with the Lord. And if you remember, the angel of the Lord went before the camp of Israel. And during the day, there was a great pillar of smoke. And at night, there was a great pillar of fire. And such a thing has never happened, obviously, in the history of the world. And I think Moses is looking back on this. And the law was delivered during this period, these 40 years. The saints are sitting down at the feet of the Lord, and they're learning his law. And again, it evokes to me the image of Jesus coming, and people sitting at his feet while he delivers as the great deliverer, the perfect deliverer. He is the king. He is the king of Jeshurun, the righteous, the true righteous. And he brings the people together and gives them a heritage of law. So it's so, when I read it, I just was amazed at the majesty of the description. Because it's so easy for the people, perhaps, to gloss over it and not think about it. And here Moses is reminding them that what an amazing ancestry. Many of the people there saw it, and those who didn't are the first generation since it happened. And so he's reminding them of this great heritage that they have.
Yeah, Moses is looking back over the last 40 years, right before. Good. Anybody else on this question? So it is poetic, and kind of difficult to know exactly what's going on. So in the upcoming slides, I think some of it has a connection with the other way, with how the land's divided. So there we have a map there we can look at. And as Matt mentioned, a lot of this connects in with Genesis 49. So we can kind of see how Moses' blessing connects with that of Jacob. Let's move on to the next question. This question number 2 deals with verses 6 and 7. It says, what blessings were given to Reuben and Judah And what older son of Jacob was excluded? Grant, would you like to address this?
The words here are certainly few for Reuben. Let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few. Of course, as Shahi pointed out, it's essentially the same thing he said twice. If there are people who don't die, of course the population may be at large. Let them live and not die. It could be that they maybe overcome difficulties that normally would kill other people, so they're going to perhaps not die because they've overcome these difficulties. Let them live and not die. Let them multiply largely upon the earth, it's essentially what the blessing is there. For Judah, it says, hear, Lord, the voice of Judah. So may God hear what Judah has to say, what Judah's concerns are. Bring him to his people. I'm not too sure actually what exactly that would mean. Let his hands be sufficient for him. I think that essentially means that what he produces for himself, what he is able to work and gain for himself, let that be enough to keep them satisfied and not to seek beyond more than what they are able to make for themselves. You help, and may you be a help against his enemies. So of course, protect them against their enemies that would come against them. Protect them. Let them live. The older son of Jacob that is excluded is Simeon, obviously. The first four children are Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. We see here Reuben and Judah, and the next verse is we see Levi. But Simeon is overlooked. And presumably because of what he had done when he sold his younger brother into captivity. And he's cut off from all these blessings that are being listed here.
Thank you. We also would like to address these blessings to the two tribes and the one that was left out, Reuben and Judah and Simeon. Sean?
Hard to know for sure why Simeon is excluded. It could just be that Simeon as a tribe eventually is absorbed by Judah. And in the book of Judges, in the first chapter, they campaign together. And eventually Simeon just sort of disappears as an independent tribe. So this could be looking forward to that time, and it's just assumed perhaps that Simeon is lumped in with Judah here. I mean, Judah is pictured as being constantly at war with enemies and needing to fight and rely on their hand, on their strength. And so I don't know if the reason that Reuben, Judah, and Simeon all lost their place in the line of blessing and that eventually fell to Judah was all because of sin. So Reuben committed incest, Simeon and Levi killed the Shechemites, so eventually Judah becomes the tribe of blessing and the messianic tribe. So I'm not sure about why Simeon is excluded. I kind of lean toward the idea that eventually it's because Simeon sort of is just absorbed by Judah, but welcome to other positions. The only thing I wanted to point out here is the second half of verse 7, which says, let his hands be sufficient for him. And this contains one of the word plays that I mentioned earlier. Judah in the Hebrew is Yehuda, and Yada is the Hebrew word for hands. And so Judah will have to rely on their hands for success, and that's sort of the word play here, the rely on their strength, rely on their power. In fact, in the early book of Judges, the early chapters of the book of Judges, we see Judah and Simeon conquering together, and they would be a pretty powerful tribe when it came to military exploits and things like that.
Bill?
Yeah, I stumbled onto some stuff in my reading that might shed a little light. I'm actually reading part of my answer to question number 3. But during Jacob's last words to Simeon and Levi, they were rebuked. I think you had that. They were rebuked, and it was promised that they'd be scattered. Well, as Charlie pointed out in your slide, showed Simeon being absorbed into Judah. But if you think about the events like Exodus 32, verses 25 with the golden calf, you know, the tribe of Levi really stepped up. And they did a really, really difficult thing, you know, to kill so many of their own brethren from the same nation. And then go forward into Numbers chapter 25. You know, Numbers 25, verses 6 through 15. Here's Phinehas, a Levi. And it's, to me, it's really impressive what he did. Numbers 25, starting with verse 11 through 13. Phinehas the son of Eleazar, I'm going to have to read some names. Phinehas the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore, say, behold, I give to him, Phinehas, my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. Remember, that stopped the plague that killed, I think it was 24,000, yeah, verse 9, 24,000. So then look at verse 14. Now the name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's house among the Simeonites. So here's a Simeonite that Phinehas the Levite killed. You know, so that might have added to a little bit of the putting down of the tribe of Simeon.
That's interesting, yeah. Oh, after this 400 years from Jacob's blessing to now, there's some changes, and I guess, as you pointed out, Levi, the tribe of Levi, did a lot to change that, but it doesn't look like Simeon did. Mark?
Yeah, and as we learned when we went through the book of Numbers, Simeon was part of the Southside Rebellion, and we calculated at that time that after this event, the tribe of Reuben went down 6%, the tribe of Gad went down 11%, and the tribe of Simeon went down 63%. Because of this event. And so we speculated at that time that there were many Simeonites killed during this period. But to Shahi's point, in the book of Revelation, Simeon is listed. The tribes are again listed, and it talks about those that are taken out of the tribes. And so while excluded here, Simeon is included in the book of Revelation. So it is, it's curious, one of those mysteries in Scripture.
Matt?
As far as we know, the entire Septuagint is not inspired, but the Alexandrian Septuagint, at least ancient copies of it, interject Simeon here, where it says, let Reuben live and not die. It then says, let Simeon be very numerous. Of course, that may or may not be correct, but it is interesting that at least that version of the Septuagint does include Simeon here.
Right. Yeah, I saw that in one of the commentators speculating that the dualism that Shai mentioned in verse 6 might actually be about Simeon. Kind of to Grant's point, you know, he's talking about Judah and the blessings. It seems like maybe that what, I guess this is what I was thinking about Judah, is that Moses' blessing of hear the voice of Judah is kind of a furtherance of Jacob's blessing of the scepter, the lawgiver wouldn't depart from Judah. Another interesting thing I thought or noticed was in verse number 9 of Genesis 49, it says Judah is a lion's whelp. That'll be used to describe Dan later in this chapter. It's kind of interesting. We need to go on to the next question. Question number 3. How would Levi fulfill its charge to teach the law to the people, and what was said of Benjamin? Malin?
First of all, you know, the tribe of Levi, they've already proven themselves in the past. They've, of course, been dedicated to the Lord. And here we see that they would teach by carrying out the acts of worship. Since in verse 9, you can see that, you know, they have kept the covenant. And so they would present the sacrifices of the people to the Lord, possibly including the incense in the holy place, burnt offering, maybe other holy things as well. And Benjamin, there's this verse 12 talks about the tribe of Benjamin, the Lord would shelter Benjamin continually.
Thank you. Yes, Levi was given that task to teach in Leviticus 10:11. There, the responsibility to teach Israel fell on the priest in the tribe of Levi. And then just a few chapters ago in Deuteronomy 31, they were charged to read the law every 7 years. We also would like to address how the tribe of Levi was charged to teach people and or what is said of Benjamin. Shall I?
One small thing, I found verse 10 to be very helpful. If you ever want to give a definition of what does a priest do, verse 10 says, they shall teach Jacob your judgments and Israel your law. They shall put incense before you and a whole burnt sacrifice on your altar. I thought that was a helpful, very succinct verse to say a priest teaches the law and offers worship. And so when we talk about the fact that there's no special priesthood separate and apart from the church, that all Christians are priests, and say, well, what does a priest do? This is what a priest does. A priest teaches the law and offers worship. And I thought that was a helpful and succinct verse to explain that to people.
Good observation. Anybody else on this question? Benjamin was one of Jacob's favored sons. And we see of says that we're in verse 12, I believe. The beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him and shelters him all day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. Benjamin's situated here in this center of Canaan, you know, in between the tribe of Judah and very center. So there seems to be some connection with geography there, along with the beloved of the Lord. He was certainly beloved of Jacob. You know, Jacob didn't want Benjamin to go down to Egypt. Mark?
Yeah, and I thought you were going to point out that Jerusalem is in the territory of obviously Zion itself is there in that. And I couldn't help but think, I know this is a giant stretch, but the Apostle Paul, who wrote most of the New Testament, was of the tribe of Benjamin, and certainly he was a beloved Christian. So, but I think knowing that the city of David itself is within the tribe, it's between the shoulders. Sort of geographically, it's nearly in the center.
Anybody else on this question? Move on to question number 4. Why was Joseph's blessing the longest of all, and what was said of Zebulun and Issachar? Landon?
Sure. I think simply Joseph was the longest because he was the favorite. He was Jacob's favorite child. And also, he was one of the most righteous. When he was in Egypt, he could have retaliated at his brothers and killed them, but he didn't. He showed mercy. And I really think that shows his character. As of Zebulun and Issachar, it says, they shall call to the peoples to the mountain. There they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness, for they shall partake of the abundance of seas and of the treasures of hidden in the sand. I don't really know what that means, so I'm going to let you guys talk about it.
I don't know what it means either. Well, somebody else has that under control. Who else would like to address specifically what said of Zebulun and Issachar, or why Joseph had the longest blessing? Shall I?
Well, remember that Joseph, so Judah received the blessing, but Joseph received the birthright. And the birthright was normally given to the firstborn, was given to Joseph because Joseph saved them all from death. Mm-hmm. And that meant a double portion of the inheritance. And so that's why Ephraim and Manasseh get, who are grandsons of Jacob, two sons of Joseph, get full tribal status because Joseph gets double, which means each of them get a full tribal status equal to the sons who are surrounding them. Joseph's blessing here, which we assume all applies to Ephraim and Manasseh, I suppose, really is predominantly about fertility and strength. And the word fertility or some variant thereof occurs five times, or fruitfulness rather, occurs five times in this short blessing, and so that seems to be the emphasis there. And just to say about Zebulun and Issachar, who were the fifth and sixth sons of Leah, Issachar has a very negative blessing back in Genesis 49, but much more positive here. And they would be there in Lower Galilee, as your map showed. And actually, they'd be given the Jezreel Valley, which was some of the richest land in the northern section of Canaan. So really, they were given a pretty good spot when everything was settled there on the, well.
I'm going back to the map.
There it is. Folks can see where that is there. There's Zebulun and Issachar right there. So pretty good spot for them.
Mark?
Yeah, and I think the way I lean on all of this is that this is messianic. All of these blessings are messianic. Things aren't going to turn out good for any of the tribes. All of the tribes are in deep trouble. And there, you know, 10 of them are going to go into captivity, and you know, it's going to be a mess. But I think the point of this, Moses is saying, the Messiah is coming. And so the hope of Israel is the Messiah. And so the reason you can be positive is because you're bringing forth the Messiah into the world. And Jesus, I think, Issachar is not mentioned in this, but when Jesus began his ministry in the Galilee, he mentioned Zebulun in Matthew chapter 4. He said, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And upon those who sat in the region and the shadow of death, light has dawned." I believe, for me, it's not the territory itself or the fact that, you know, there was great minerals or whatever. It's the fact that these individuals, these people, you know, they have access to the truth of Jesus Christ when it occurs. And so that's the way I would interpret the blessings. As you can see, Zebulun is right there near the Sea of Galilee. Issachar also. Naphtali, all of these places are there where Jesus did much of his ministry.
Very good point. Thank you. Anybody else on this question? What's kind of interesting about Joseph is in verse 17, talked about him being a firstborn bull and the horns of a wild ox. As we're looking through Daniel, horns, you know, they were representative of power. I wonder how that connects here, or if it does. Let's move on to question number 5. What blessings were spoken of Gad, Dan, and Naphtali? Levi?
For Gad, none of Tabor was strong. For Dan, said he was strong. For Dan, says he's a lion. Well, someone could elaborate on that. I was kind of confused about that. And Naphtali says he's satisfied with favor, and he possesses blessings, testatory. And I think it's good to note that all are positive blessings.
All positive. Thank you. We also like to talk about Dan and Gad and Naphtali.
Well, back in Genesis 49, you know, Dan was called a serpent. But as Levi pointed out accurately, I believe it's a favorable blessing at this point. But we really don't have a lot of detail, like so many of these finishing up. I found it a little interesting to wonder what is meant by the Bashan reference, and then somebody I wrote for. Read from talking about Dan. Dan led Israel into idolatry in Judges 18, 1 Kings 12, and Amos 8. So Dan's going to be a source of a lot of heartache.
Mark?
Yeah, that's the case. And in fact, one of the reasons that critics and non-believers in the Bible say that Moses didn't say these words, I read a couple of guys who said that, is because Dan hadn't moved to Bashan yet. When he takes the territory, they're in the south. When they take the initial territory of Dan, it's in the south. And then later, like 800 or so, it's Judges 18, Dan moves north to the Bashan. And that is, as Bill mentioned, that's when they commit idolatry. Remember, there's a wandering Levite that they find, and they take him up there, and they say, "You will be our priest, and you will." And they have an idol. They set up an idol there. And later, Rehoboam, when the nation divides, Rehoboam takes that same place, Jeroboam takes the same place in Dan that this tribe set up. There it is, way up near the top. I can see Dan way up there near, right up there. So that is where they set up this altar in Judges 18, and they committed idolatry there with this wandering Levite. And so, Bill has a good memory that, it's been discussed before. So it's Moses, and it is a pot, obviously, he doesn't specifically say anything negative, but he does prophetically say that they're going to leap from Bashan. So to me, it looks like this is referencing the fact that they're going to lead the apostasy, which Jeroboam will then use to his benefit and lead the 10 northern tribes. They don't go down to Jerusalem anymore. They stay up north, and they worship the false gods of the north.
So?
Yeah, I don't have a good memory. I was able to find that and read it. But I also had a little bit of heartburn thinking about Reuben and Gad. You remember back in Numbers 32, these were the tribes that didn't want to go into Canaan. We're happy on the east side. And yet here's favorable blessings for both of them. Let them be Reuben, where was it at? Let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few. Again, favorable blessings on people. Now, somewhere, somebody I've read talked about Reuben providing a lot of troops. But, we study that, too. And they didn't provide what they had promised that they would provide. But yet, there's favorable blessings for these tribes as well.
Right. This does, the blessing on Gad does seem to connect with their aggression in that area of conquering that land. Matt?
Yeah, let's remember Moses is about to die. And he has said several unfavorable things about these people throughout their entire lives, so the fact that this is the last thing he's going to say, maybe not totally surprising that it's uplifting and maybe beneficial for this overall morale booster.
Okay. We need to move on to the last question. We're running out of time. Question number 6. How was Asher most blessed of sons, and how did Moses conclude his blessings? Bart?
Well, I don't have a great answer for this as far as why he's the most blessed of sons. My bias, obviously, is that this is not topographic blessings. This is messianic blessings. And when you say you're blessed, that means happy. And Jesus, when he stood on the Mount of Beatitudes and gave the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, that's what he says, blessed are those, happy are those. And so he's literally, I don't know if he's literally saying Asher are those. But the idea is happy are those who are righteous and who dip their foot in oil. Oil is representative of the Holy Spirit. Listen to the words of God. Sandals referring of being iron and bronze, God did not let their sandals wear out as they walked through the wilderness. And similar blessings are made to the disciples of the Lord, that you shall tread on serpents and so on. If you go in the strength of Christ, then you're invulnerable. God obviously will work your will and his will in your life, and God blesses us as we need to be blessed. So I think, to me, that's the blessing of Asher, of those who are righteous to the Lord. We have one Asherite mentioned in the New Testament, at least maybe there's some others, but the one I'm familiar with is Anna, who is a daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. And she was a godly woman who did not depart from the temple, served God with fastings and prayers, and she lived to see Jesus brought to the temple, to be presented in the temple, and she saw God's redemption. So there was an Asherite that was blessed and was able to witness Christ. So that, to me, that's the answer to how are they the most blessed. Just like all the Israelites, they, if they're faithful to God, then they are blessed. And then the conclusion of this section is just as amazing as the beginning. I was so impressed by the beginning of how Moses opened. And these are the very last words of Moses that we have here. And he reassures the people as he's about to climb Mount Nebo that there is no God like the God of the righteous, who literally rides on the heavens to help you. He is your refuge, he says. He will thrust out your enemy. No enemy can stand. You know, David, perhaps, little David, some years later, some centuries later, read these words, and no enemy stands, Goliath or whoever, no enemy stands against the God. And again, happy are you, verse 29, Asher are you, if you are saved by the Lord. He is your shield and your sword, and your enemies shall submit to you. And all these blessings, again, it's apocalyptic in the sense that they are repeated in the book of Revelation. They're repeated in the Beatitudes by the Lord as he stood, but they're also repeated in the book of Revelation. No enemy will stand against the church. The church is triumphant, like Gad. An enemy will stamp on you, but you will have victory at last. And that's true of the church. Things may look bad for the church, and society may turn against the church, but the Lord will give the church victory.
I think Bart's right that these blessings are certainly messianic and not so much as promises to these tribes. But a lot of the language is kind of abstract as to how it points to the Messiah and to Jesus. But I think verse 26 is something that would have been like almost you'd have to like force yourself to miss. There is no God like the God of Jeshurun or Yeshurun, which is incredibly similar to Yeshua, which, you know, Joshua, Jesus, the deliverance of God. Those two words are nearly identical as far as the Hebrew roots go. So to take the abstract language and combine it with that, I think you get a broader picture. And like I said, I think Bart's absolutely correct.
Shall I?
Back in verse 16, when speaking to Joseph, Moses said, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. This is a very rare, I think, reference to God meeting with Moses at the burning bush back in Exodus chapter 3. And I thought how interesting it is that in this place, Moses comes full circle to the time when God commissioned him, first called upon him, to go out and to deliver his people from bondage. And now he's come to the end of that mission and very briefly reflects back on that time when the Lord appeared to him. But something I thought about also is that like Moses, who's gathered his people together for this final address, Jesus does something very similar with his apostles in John 14, 15, 16, and then in John 17. And I thought about how here, Simeon is absent, and for Jesus, Judas was absent as he had departed from the apostolic group. Just as Moses here mingled admonitions and promises, Jesus expounded upon the mission of his disciples and the comfort they should have knowing that the Lord would be with them every step of the way. Moses spoke of the blessings which awaited Israel in the promised land if they will endure and trust in the Lord. And that's exactly what Jesus did. In fact, Jesus opened that speech, those final words that he would speak on the earth in John 14, beginning in verse 1, with well-known words from the Lord. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know. So very much like Moses, Jesus delivered these words of comfort, these words of reassurance, that yes, there will be some challenges ahead, but if you persevere and you make it through those trials, then you'll receive the blessings of the promised land on the other side.